From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Advice Show. This week we're joined by Catherine Foot from Standard Life. Catherine, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me.
General one to start. Much change in the pensions world. What's your sort of assessment of the landscape?
Exciting times.
Exciting times,
I think, at last. Yeah. I think there's lots and lots of positive movement at the moment from this current government in particular, trying to solve what it recognises and acknowledges as some of the big systemic challenges that future generations of retirees are facing. You know, we've come a long way since automatic enrolment was introduced, since pension freedoms, learnt a lot about the good and the bad of the situation that we're in at the moment. And I think what you can see is a government and an industry and a kind of civil society all interested now in really actively taking pensions policy and our pension system to the next stage and solving for today's problems, which is exciting. Yes, but it's very, very busy, certainly.
And what, and your sort of role as the leader of Standard Life Centre for the Future of Retirement think tank, what are some of the central issues that you guys have discovered or have been sort of calling out for a long time?
Well, so, I mean, the big one is just simply adequacy.
Yeah.
Simply this question of, have people got enough in their pots? And what we can see from any kind of modelling you choose to look at, our own analysis, the Institute for Fiscal Studies recently published their big pensions review, which did some work. DWP have their own big simulating model. It's hard to predict with absolute certainty, of course, but however you look at it, it seems pretty clear that most people in the sort of retiring decades coming up, in the work that we've done, the problem peaks in the early 2040s, but most people look at the moment set to be retiring on simply not enough.
Is that those who missed out on the automatic enrolment reforms?
Yeah, you've got this sort of
sweet spot.
Exactly. That sort of kind of young Gen X, older millennial kind of cohort, where you've got an initial period in working life without automatic enrolment. Mm. So a much higher proportion of people saving nothing into their pension at all in the early decades of their working life. Automatic enrolment only coming in sort of halfway through, but they've also typically missed out, if they're private sector workers, on defined benefit pensions too. Yeah. So yeah, the problem seems almost most acute for that group. Although for younger generations, you've got a more acute situation with lack of home ownership and housing affordability. Yeah. So the problem isn't solved yet for any generation, which is why I'm so excited about the scale and the ambition of the reforms that are being debated at the moment.
Do you think the government have a grasp on sort of what a big crisis this could be coming down the track? Perhaps not for them, perhaps for three or four governments.
I think increasingly. I mean, we are absolutely waiting with bated breath for them to launch this second phase of their pensions review. So we're waiting, hopefully, in the Mansion House speech for the beginning of the second phase, the pensions or retirement income adequacy review. We've been waiting for it for a little while, but it was wonderful to see it promised in the manifesto, and hopeful that that is a process that will deliver the right sort of roadmap at the right speed to improve retirement outcomes.
And ideally, what sort of recommendations do you think you would be hopeful that they'll be looking for within that review, or how do you think, or how what would be the ideal way for them to go about that review?
Well, while I fully understand, you know, the ambition for the government to look at this comprehensively and seriously and thoughtfully, I also feel very strongly that this is an issue of some urgency. So I'll be looking in particular at not just the specific terms of reference of the adequacy review and exactly what it's going to cover. You know, is it going to just look at private pensions? To what extent is it going to incorporate, for example, the next review of the state pension age or a future of the state pension? Is it going to be looking at other sources of retirement income or just our just pension income? We don't know any of that yet. So I'll be looking not just at the terms of reference and exactly what it's going to cover, but also how long they intended to take.
Yes.
And when you then might get the sorts of actual action, legislative or otherwise, to begin to make the changes that we need to see.
Yeah, you mentioned the IFS earlier and the state pension just then. The OBR released some quite stark figures about that today. That
they did.
Might represent 7.5% of our overall GDP within the next 50 years. I mean, yeah. What do you think about those statistics?
Yeah, second only to our NHS.
Well, yeah, and perhaps defence by then.
Yeah, true. In terms of, yeah, but huge, huge sort of proportion of the cost of our of our future public finances. And of course, that places huge fiscal pressure on the government. It is by far and away the most popular part of our benefit system, the state pension.
Yeah.
So I'm not one of those people who see a future in which it no longer exists or in which it's, you know, scaled back in some really significant way.
For them to sort of scrap it, it's
incredibly popular. It's, you know, it's one of these universal benefits that we really value as a population, a bit like the NHS, that we really value.
And I think everybody's and we aware really care of about. It's something that they get if they pay in.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And it's really important, I think, to set that kind of shared fundamental foundation.
Yeah.
That sort of protection from destitution, if you like, that is then your basic foundation on which you can build with workplace saving, with private pension saving. I think having that kind of universal base guarantee is really important.
Do you think there's ever a world where we would means test it, like the Australians do, for instance? Do you
think that would... I think that's pretty unlikely, actually, partly because, as I say, it's extremely popular, but also because actually... Relatively, it's not relatively to the sort of levels of state pension in other countries. It's not huge. Yeah. So we have a pension system that is by design expecting people will save quite significantly through occupational pensions and through the system of automatic enrolment.
Yeah.
So we've kind of protected to a large extent the really big fiscal risks of a growing state pension that some of the other countries in Northern Europe, for instance, face. So I don't personally see that very realistically on the cards.
Maybe coming back to the second stage of the pensions review adequacy, do you think there's scope for the lowering of the automatic enrolment rate from 22 to 18? Do you think that's something that the government should look at?
I do, and I hope that it will.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Is it 18? Is it 16? I don't know. I think these are the sorts of conversations that we need to start to have. Of course, what we need to get right is this balance between making sure that, you know, the median earner over the course of a lifetime is going to end up with an adequate retirement income. But that does mean making sure that you're not putting people at risk of oversaving into their pensions at times when, exactly, at times when, you know, the perfect sort of smoothing of their finances over their life course would mean something different. So these are, you know, technically, I think, solvable problems. And I'm sure that the adequacy review will focus very hard on what the right answer is there.
You mentioned there about being able to sort of have money for certain things during that, I suppose, working lifetime.
Yeah.
There have been some suggestions over the last few months. I don't think anybody's suggesting it sort of outright, but that maybe people might be able to release money from their pension or borrow money from their pension for their first house purchase. What do you think about ideas?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting suggestion. For me, what it speaks to is, I guess, this situation that we now find ourselves in where DC pensions are essentially just pots of money with certain rules and a nice tax wrapper around them. We did some public deliberative work at our think tank a couple of years ago, all about the future of the pension system, future of the state pension. And a guy on one of the focus group tables stood up at one point and said, we should stop calling them pensions, shouldn't we? If this is a pot of money, is it really a pension? Because he interpreted that word pension as a guaranteed retirement income for life, as something quite different. So I suppose that's, you know, that question about house purchases is one example, I think, of what is the right next debate to be having about, you know, what are people's income needs over the course of a life and what is the role of our kind of, you know, systems of tax relief and pensions versus other forms of saving to get people to that right overall financial well-being across their life.
I don't
think
that gentleman is alone. I was actually at an event with Luke Charters, the MP who's just gone on paternity leave until October, famously. And he was saying that he would advocate for a similar system where he would change the name of defined contribution pots to sort of retirement savings.
There's so much jargon in pensions land, isn't there? Yeah. Boy, oh boy. I think that's one example. There's probably many others where we could do with some more plain English descriptions of what these things are. Yeah.
And what are some of the general responses that, sort of speaking to your own colleagues and perhaps peers at other providers as well, are sort of eager and waiting bated breath to feed back to the government in that second stage?
Well, of course, we've also got the pension schemes bill.
We do, yeah.
Happening at the moment. Okay, we'll come on to that later. All right. Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of adequacy, it is, what is the right, you know, next direction of travel for automatic enrolment, and what is the right timetable and roadmap for getting to a better outcome for most people? That's the question. So I think, you know, we'll be feeding in data about likely risks for different populations at different times. This question of, you know, people at different income levels over the course of a life, because not all people on low incomes stay on low incomes all the way through all the way through their lives. So we've got to look at these sort of lifetime effects. It's also important to recognise when we're thinking about retirement adequacy that we often don't just work and retire alone. We're often part of households with partners, with parents, with children, with people that depend on us and that we depend on. And so there'll be a lot of work, I think, to do. And we hope very much to feed in very actively to this next review from the government to build models of both individual and household broad retirement income adequacy that then help you begin to think about, well, if you pull this lever over here, if you reduce, the age at which automatic enrolment starts, if you increase the default contribution rates, you know, what are you solving or not solving? Who are you solving the problem for or not? And I think doing that sort of work is really, really important. And the IFS review, has already put forward some ideas there. Yeah. I think the other really important thing that we'll be looking for the review to cover is this, is of course this question of sort of practical implementation.
Yeah.
So you can have the best perfect, you know, the most sort of ideal system in the world for getting this right, but employers are going to be responsible for implementing it.
Yeah.
This might place, you know, new burdens on both employers and savers themselves.
How willing are they going to be to do that post the sort of NI rise?
And so what is the right timetable? What are the economic conditions that we need to be right before we begin to see automatic enrolment default contribution rates increase, for example? And, you know, how gradual might we set that level of increase over how long? So that's sort of what the right answer is. And that journey, that roadmap and commitment to get us from here to there, that's what we need to see in this review.
Do you think it would fit, though? I mean, you mentioned the pension scheme bill earlier. Lots of the things in there are sort of timetable for 2030 or before 2030. Do you think it would fit with the government's plan that they want sort of some of the changes that might come about as a result of the second stage to be in by then? Or do you think that's too soon?
Well, so the pensions minister has been quite clear in terms of...
Very bullish.
But in terms of... when default contribution rates would change, that it's not this parliament, that it is, it would come later. And I think, though, that there is lots of work to be done to set the legislative framework in place, set the regulations in place, set the plan in place, build that roadmap, build that engagement with employers, do that work with the public too, to engage them in some of these questions over this next little period. So I'm optimistic that there is that sense of urgency from this government, just as there is from industry. And when you begin to talk to people from pension savers themselves too, that means that we will see action fairly promptly. Yeah.
And lots of your work as part of the think tank looks at sort of societal changes and how working sort of patterns change. What's your assessment of how the pensions landscape has changed in sort of the 13 years since RDR and then all of those sort of raft of legislative changes that came in after that?
Well, one thing we haven't talked about, I suppose, yet, is this extraordinary and impossible transformation that the system expects us all to make in a DC environment post-RDR2, from being broadly inadequately, but nevertheless broadly protected through automatic enrolment from needing to think very much about our pensions at all to suddenly being, you know, thrown to the wolves in terms of the decision making we have to make, totally responsible as individuals for all these risks.
Yeah.
You know, longevity risk, investment risk, inflation risk, becoming, as is so often said, you know, your own actuary, your own financial advisor, you know. So that transition, I mean, that's bonkers, isn't it? Mm. That can't be a transition that we can reasonably expect people to be able to make without more support. Mm. So one of the bits of work that we've been looking at lately is this new idea of a new regulated activity of targeted support to try and bridge this gap for people who will never be able to afford fully independent regulated financial advice because their pots just simply, their incomes just simply aren't large enough. But who definitely need some more help in an environment where we're increasingly seeing and will, you know, definitely increasingly see over the next 5, 10, 15 years, people retiring with not insignificant sums of money in DC pots. And so the risk of them making the wrong decision is ever greater. And at the moment, we don't have a system that's providing people with enough support, I don't think.
And do you think those targeted support reforms, FCA released them sort of 2 weeks ago now, do you think they go far enough or do you think there is more to be done?
I think they're a really important piece of the answer, I suppose. Yeah. There's a lot more, I think, to think through about how to really make them work. We have just been working actually for the last 6 months with a panel of 30 consumers, people who typically weren't particularly engaged in their pensions. All over 45. Mostly not particularly engaged with their pensions, sort of pretty representative in that sense of the population. One or two who have taken some decumulation decisions.
Was that a deliberate sort of
deliberate design. Exactly. And then we've been working with them for a few months on what would targeted support do for them?
Yeah.
How ought it to work best to help them? And what you see, you know, really strongly coming out of that work that we'll be publishing actually later this week is the potential for this sort of support to make some progress reducing feelings of kind of anxiety and overwhelm that people begin to face when they start realizing, when you were saying pensions might not be a great term, but when you start to get into the world of, you know, annuities and drawdown, terms people really may not be familiar with. So I think it's got real potential. And there's much more work to do, I think, from the regulator and with industry and with others to design it well. And I think it's also only ever going to be part of the answer. One of the things we found in the work actually was that for some people, what I think it will do is put them in a more confident position to then choose to pay for independent financial advice.
I think that's what the FCA and sort of providers are hoping for, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because targeted support is free at the point of use.
Exactly.
Transition into further advice.
So for some, that might be all they can afford and it might be enough. But for others, I think it will give them the sorts of information and the sorts of kind of armoury, if you like, to then feel that they've got confidence in then going to an IFA and getting that more personalised support.
Yeah.
But you know, the consumers on our panel were really clear and it wasn't hard for them to get the idea that targeted support isn't that kind of perfectly personalised. The idea of it isn't that perfectly personalised advice.
Yeah.
But that nevertheless, having that sort of, well, people who are a bit like you tend to do this, support would help.
Because that's what firms are scared of, isn't it? That the customer's going to turn around and say this was advice and take them to the FOS. But you're saying that the clients that you were sort of dealing with, or potential clients you were dealing with, were able to easily identify sort of differences.
Exactly. I mean, I think whenever you spend time with people, even people who have not been particularly engaged in their pensions up to now, or people who haven't been consider themselves particularly financially confident or financially literate or sort of numerate. We're all still grown-ups and we can all still understand what something is and isn't, as long as it's communicated really clearly and really well. So it's absolutely beholden on regulators and industry to get that communication right and to do that really well. Because if you do, then it's perfectly easy for people to understand what this is and what this isn't.
Yeah, I know that one of the challenges I think you identified was that people with multiple pensions, as is increasingly a thing with defined contribution pots, it might be difficult for them. But I mean, is that where the sort of pension dashboard comes into play? Might that sort of iron out that crease?
Yes, I'm so pleased that that we are seeing, you know, continued commitments to progress on pensions dashboards, because that's another sort of, you were asking earlier about, you know, what have been some of the big changes over the last 10, 15 years, and that proliferation of small pots and what that then means for people's ability then to make decisions is a huge issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, in what other walk of life would you be expected to follow kind of messy paper trails through multiple companies that have sold each other to each other and to each other five times over until you find, you know, find where your money's got to. So, I'm very excited at the prospect of the launch of pensions dashboards. And I think that interconnectedness between the data that's used in pensions dashboards and the information you might get from then, and then you then being able to seek out a targeted support offer, money helper, pensions buyers guidance, you know, whatever is the right next step for you is going to be really valuable.
Just sort of going back to something that you were talking about earlier in terms of the transition, I suppose, that we're going through, and what I think by the end of this decade, there'll be more DC money than defined benefit money. Do you think it's an issue that nobody saw coming down the track, or just that everybody wanted to sort of kick down the road and didn't want to deal with it? Now we're dealing with the repercussions of those decisions and issues.
You're asking why did people not see this coming in terms of the decline of DB?
Yeah, not that people didn't see it coming, but I mean, there are obviously issues with DC, people not having enough money, people not saving enough. Are these issues that people should have dealt with more, I suppose, earlier this
morning? Well, hindsight is a wonderful thing, isn't it? I mean, I think I'd be generous on that front. If you take something like the default contribution rates, people were really worried, weren't they, around the time of the turnover review and the you know, the introduction of automatic enrolment, that people would opt out in large numbers. And trying to get that number right in a safe way that would begin to build up people's workplace pension savings in a world where, you know, corporations have kind of begun to exit en masse from DB without them feeling like it was a burden they should just get rid of for now, was a huge, huge concern. Turns out that nudges are incredibly effective. And it's, you know, since then, of course, been much lauded as you know, far and away the most effective example of kind of nudge theory in practice in any public policy change pretty much globally there's ever been. But at the time, we didn't know. So I'm delighted now, though, that we're getting to that stage where there is this broad consensus that we have this looming problem now in terms of pensions adequacy and action looks set to be on the cards.
And sort of more generally, I suppose, how does the second stage fit with the first stage of the pensions review? The government are pretty keen, I think, to at least get some element of investment or mandated investment from firms into the UK. How does that tally with sort of member benefits and member outcomes, in your view?
Well, so the government's got a lot of problems that it's trying to solve all at once, and quite right too. And I sit here most principally concerned with adequacy and with long-term financial security for people. But I also acknowledge that they are working and saving in a country that has not seen economic growth for, to the level that we want to see it for a very long time. That's seen stagnant wages, and, really low wage growth for an incredibly long time. And there was news today about, you know, the 4.5 million children, I think it is now, that are living in living in poverty. So I think, you know, some of these different pieces of the puzzle are trying to solve different problems.
Yes.
They're trying to address different issues, aren't they?
Do you think they're all looking, do you think they're all driving in the same direction, or do you think they're all looking at different areas for that sort of magic growth that might or might not come?
Well, I think, you know, the theory is that you will be able to invest pension funds in, you know, productive UK assets that will both deliver those member outcomes and deliver economic growth to the UK, isn't it? That's the theory. And I think there's an awful lot of potential for that to be true. Personally, I'm not an investment expert. As I say, my area is very much that adequacy end and that improving financial security for individuals.
Yeah.
But I appreciate it's a very lively topic of debate, isn't it? The extent to which firms should be mandated, for example.
Catherine, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.